Blog Talk Radio.
You are now listening to True Murder, the most shocking killers in true crime history, and the authors that have written about them. Gacy, Bundy, Dahmer, The Night Stalker, BTK. Every week, another fascinating author talking about the most shocking and infamous killers in true crime history. True Murder, with your host, journalist and author, Dan Zupansky.
Good evening. Watch Me Die is a first-hand account of Ohio's death row and the state's execution process unlike any other. Dr. Kimberlin, a trained clinical psychologist and professor of psychology, goes beyond the prison walls and into the world of death row inmates. No bars, no shackles, and no chains. Kimberlin spends time one-on-one with some of Ohio's worst killers to learn about their life on death row. Then he watches them die. You will see how these inmates think as Kimberlin not only spends time interviewing them, but also eats meals with them, and in some cases is the last person to speak to them before they are executed. You'll also be walked through the full execution process, starting from when the inmate is placed on suicide watch and going until they are pronounced dead on the execution table. You will see the flaws in the system and be able to judge for yourself if the death penalty as it is utilized today is really worth pursuing. This book promises to take you into the depths of death row and into the minds of the killers like no one else has ever been able to do before. You will see their artwork, their writings, and their mindset as they prepare for their final days on this planet. The book that we're featuring this evening is Watch Me Die, with my guest, author and professor, Dr. Bill Kimberlin. Welcome to the program, and thank you for agreeing to this interview, Dr. Bill Kimberlin.
Thank you for having me on here. It's an honor. Thank you.
Thank you very much. This is an incredible, like I said when I spoke to you earlier, incredible perspective that it's just amazing the information that you have presented here in this book. Let's talk about your background as a psychologist before we talk about why you decided to study death row. What is your background before you got to that point? And then you can tell us how you came to that decision that you wanted to study death row. Tell us why, but give us your background before that that prepared you to be even be in a position that you made the query on death row. So tell us how your background that put you in a position to ask the question to want to study death row.
Sure. So when I first graduated with a bachelor's degree in criminal justice and sociology, and I became an adult probation parole officer here in Ohio, and I always knew I wanted to continue my education. So while I was a probation parole officer, I received my master's degree from Heidelberg University in counseling. So I entered the counseling arena at the same time as being a probation officer. But what I always planned on doing was becoming a college professor. And I always knew that it would take years to get to that level because of the degrees that you'd normally have to obtain, which would be at the doctorate level. So when I was doing the counseling and the probation, I was constantly working on my degrees, and I eventually obtained my doctorate in clinical psychology. So it's all of the human sciences, social sciences background, which is what I've always been interested in, and I've always interacted with people, and mostly of those that are at risk. The probationers are all convicted of felons, and then my drug and alcohol counseling days with those individuals, and then moving into the clinical psychology, more into the study of the mind. And one thing I always told myself was I would never be the type of professor that would teach just book smarts only, meaning I wanted to be able to learn as much as I could firsthand. And some of the biggest debated issues in a lot of the social classes are things such as the legalization of drugs here in America, our gun laws, whether or not we need to relax them, abortion rights, and then, of course, capital punishment. And I've been fortunate enough to travel to a number of different countries to see what their drug laws are like, and growing up around guns and things of that nature, I knew enough about those areas. But when it came to capital punishment, everything that I had read literature-wise pointed me in the direction to find out that none of the authors had ever really visited death row, let alone witnessed an execution. So I thought this is a good starting point to make sure that I didn't fall in that trap of only teaching what I've read. So then I dove into death row head first, I guess, to see what I could learn. And in doing so, I just happened to call the Attorney General's office at the time and asked them to put me on a list or in the lottery to witness an execution, because I, like everyone else, had no idea how this process worked. And they hung up on me. And I thought, well, that was kind of rude. So I called back and I said, you know, I'm hoping that we just got disconnected, but I'm really serious about getting in to see an execution. I teach on this stuff, and I need to know more about it. And the young lady on the other end said, you know, nobody can just witness an execution. The governor of Ohio had never witnessed one. The attorney general's never witnessed one. The Ohio Revised Code set forth the procedures in which a person can witness an execution, and only three people on each side can ever witness an execution out of 30 million people in Ohio. So she said, but since I've never been asked this question before, I'm going to send you the law and the list of the people that are scheduled to be executed in the state of Ohio over the next year or two. See if you can find any loopholes and have at it. So I got the list. I got the law. I got together with some attorney friends of mine that I'd always worked with, one who's a judge now, and found some loopholes, decided to contact a couple of the inmates, and that's how I became involved in death row, and it has just mushroomed from there.
Now, you mentioned that one of the key assets that you did have was a personal friend, and then you mentioned now a judge, Roger Bennett, and he was the assistant county prosecutor, and he was the person that gave you the number of the attorney general, so even he didn't really know that how impossible it seemed, insurmountable, you know, a task that you had to overcome. So when you had this, there was only going to be the strict criteria for anybody to be able to witness this execution. How then did you go ahead, and you talk about Roger Bennett and his connection. Again, if you had a connection to an inmate, tell us some of that criteria under those conditions you could get to witness an execution, and it was luckily that through Roger Bennett you did get that opportunity. So tell us how that worked with Roger.
Okay, so Roger and I have been best of friends for, you know, we grew up together, and at the time he was an assistant prosecutor, has since been elected as common police court judge, and he said, because he had worked with the attorney general so close, he gave me literally their direct number. At the time, it was Betty Montgomery. So I had the contact number, and I was also fortunate enough to know that one of the inmates that was listed on the sheet that was given to me, given the dates of the executions, he happened to be related to one, Chris Newton, by marriage. And he said that he could vouch for me if need be. So I decided to write Chris Newton explaining who I was and friends of Roger, and he decided to write back. Chris was a very unique character when it comes to somebody psychologically studying them, and one of the first letters I got back was, I would love for you to come down and talk to me face-to-face, and in fact, tell Roger I no longer want to kill him, because he always wanted to kill Roger, but I no longer want to kill him, so if he wants to come down and visit me, he can too, before my execution. So I went down first, met with him a couple times, took Roger down. Next thing you know, Chris Newton actually asked me to be there for his execution.
Wow. Now, let's just go back a little bit, because you do set the stage on Ohio's uniqueness in terms of how they – you also mentioned in the book, if I'm not correct, is it 33 or 35 states still have the death penalty?
Correct. 35 states – it gets kind of confusing. 35 states can enact the death penalty right now. 33 of those states have active death penalties,
right,
meaning – two of those states, they abolished the death penalty, but they kept their death rows active. And then, of course, the federal government here in the United States supersedes all of our states' constitutions. So, in essence, you could be put to death by the federal government if you're convicted of a capital murder offense in a state that does not have the death penalty, and it happens on federal property.
Right. Now, tell us about the unique, like you're not comparing every other state in the United States, but talk about what you saw as what you thought was quite unique in the treatment of death row prisoners, and also explain to the main locations in this is Chillicothe,
yes.
Chillicothe, and also Lucasville, and tell us about their role in this death penalty in terms of location.
Okay. Well, when I first started, obviously my very first trip to death row, I was nervous as can be because I did not know what to expect. You know, it's not a very transparent area within our criminal justice system, meaning that there's a lot of secretive stuff that goes on with death row. They just don't let the public know a whole lot. So I was really going into it blind. And once I got on the death row, I was assuming, based on some of the TV shows that I had seen over the years, that these guys would be handcuffed and shackled. They'd be locked down in their cells 23 hours a day. They'd pump sunlight into them, you know, everything like that. Lo and behold, I get to death row, which is now housed in Chillicothe, Ohio. Prior to that, when I first started, we had two different locations, one in Mansfield, Ohio, and one in Youngstown, Ohio. So when I started, I was actually going to two different death rows. We have since combined them, put them all in Chillicothe, Ohio. But in order for them to be executed, they're transferred about 36 hours before their execution down to Lucasville, which is on the border of Ohio and Kentucky. And that's where the death house sits. But going back to the actual death row, I was completely and utterly shocked to see how much freedom our death row inmates here in Ohio get and the amenities that they have access to. So every single person that I've ever dealt with on Ohio's death row actually would prefer to be on death row than in general population, because they have so much more freedom. They're out of their cells most of the day. They get their rec time inside and out. They have access. They have TVs in their cells. They have access to handheld video games, MP3 players, so they can select music. They have access to computers. They have their own typewriters. They can order food boxes of whatever kind of food that they desire. Some they can order different tennis shoes, whether they want Nikes or Converse or Adidas. They're allowed 3 fully nude pictures sent to them every single day, as long as there are no pictures depicting penetration. And the art, they have tons of art supplies that they can order. So these inmates, the worst of the worst, are treated very, very well. That doesn't even include the medical care that they get, because Ohio will literally go to extraordinary measures to keep them alive in order to execute them. So there's one of my inmates who's been on death row whose medical bills have exceeded over $1 million, and they have done this in order to keep him alive so they can execute him. So when I get to death row, I was thinking that these guys would be in a cage locked up, and then I would talk to them through a telephone or through glass. But instead, when I started in Mansfield, it was just a room that we were in with no handcuffs on or anything. And now in Chillicothe, no handcuffs, no shackles. Depending on when the visitation is taking place or the interview, we can walk up and down death row free to ourselves and discuss anything we want. We can eat out of the vending machines unless it's towards the end of their sentence. So the week before, then they would allow us to order food to be delivered to the prison. So one of the last guys I witnessed, I think we ordered $80 worth of Italian food, and they actually delivered it to us right there to death row. So I was taken aback, I guess, at how easy our death row inmates have it. It's very quiet there. It's very clean. Everybody gets along. I've never seen any fights, no yelling or anything like that. So I guess I was just completely caught off guard on that.
Now before we talk about the various methods of execution that you outline in your book in different parts of America, and also you outline the type of execution, of course, that they're going to utilize, they did utilize in Ohio, and they utilize today in Ohio, and a couple of very interesting facts about the behavior of the pharmaceutical companies, very interesting as well. But let's talk about the worst of the worst. For example, the very first, I believe, very first person that you spoke to was Chris Newton. So tell us what Chris Newton was noted for and the peculiar behavior that he exhibited.
So Chris was a Satan worshiper, and he had very little regard for human life. And he knew enough that he did not fit into society, but he hated prison. So he was actually in prison on low-level felonies, breaking and entering, robbing, but not armed robbery or anything like that. And he just knew that he could not survive in the outside world without doing a lot of harm to a lot of people. But he didn't want to live in prison either. So he decided that he would use the state as a method of suicide, because one thing about the death row inmates, they can kill anybody but themselves, which is a whole different topic. So Chris decided that he was going to be put in protective custody. He was going to lie to the guards, telling that the gangs were after him. And the entire time he was plotting what he was going to do. So the guards agreed to put him in protective custody, and they were walking him back there, and he was looking in the different cells to see who was around, and he spotted one individual. He had no idea who he was, but he looked weak, and he told the guard, "That guy and I, we get along, you can sell me with him." And the guards were like, "Fine." So they decided to bunk him and this other inmate together, and Chris knew that that's the person he was going to kill. He just needed something to spark it. So he told that inmate the next night, "Listen, you and I, after lights out, we're going to have sex." And the guy said, "No, that's not anything that I'm interested in." And Chris told me that's the spark that he needed. So when the lights went out, he decided to beat and strangle this guy to death. And in doing so, he got so sexually aroused and turned on that he started rubbing the blood all over him and drinking it, and then proceeded to masturbate all over him. And then when he was finished, he sat down and ate a pear until the guards arrived the next morning, because nobody heard anything because they were in protective custody and the doors are kind of solid. And I have the crime scene photos and of Chris standing there laughing, covered completely naked in blood. And it was bizarre to listen to him tell me the story. And then he went on to tell the court that murder he did was to get him the death penalty, and that if the court would not give him the death penalty, he was going to continue to murder until they did. So the blood would be on their hands, not his. And that's how he ended up getting the death penalty.
Incredible. What was the most incredible thing about the interview with Christopher Newton?
Probably the every time that I interviewed him, which was numerous times, you could sense that he could not wait to die. And he just could not, the date of his execution would not get there soon enough. And I remember distinctly sitting in the room with him all alone, and we're laughing and talking about something, because he was a very, very humorous, funny individual. He was from a psychologist standpoint, he was great to interview. So we were sitting there, and again, no guards or anything were around us. The door opens after about being in there maybe a half hour or 45 minutes, and Chris was, he had tobacco in his mouth. And we were talking, and the case manager, the guard at the time, looks at Newton and says, "Newton, I should write you up for that. You know you're not allowed to be chewing in here." And Chris stopped with the coldest eyes of a stare that I've ever seen, looked directly at him and told him that, "Yeah, I know, and I've always wanted to kill you too. And the only reason I haven't killed you is because I want to die on my date of execution. But so help me God, I will kill you right now if you don't get out of this room." And it must have stunned the guard enough, because he looked right back at me and said, "He's all yours," and just left and shut the door. And then Chris turned right back to me and he jokingly said, "Now what were we talking about?" And I said the first thing that came to mind, I said, "You were talking about killing him, not me." And he laughed it off, and we went back to our interview. But Chris was very, very bizarre in nature, because of the fact that he just did not have any regard for human life at all. No remorse, would kill again, wanted to kill and rape all the way to his execution date, because he was naming people that he wished he would have killed. And in fact, his execution took 2 hours from start to finish, and he actually had to get up off the table when they were trying to put the IVs in at one time to go use the restroom. And they allowed him to do that, and then he came back and hopped back on.
Incredible.
Yeah.
Now let's just
He never argued. Oh, I'm sorry, go ahead.
No, go ahead.
He never resisted. He never argued with anybody. Even during his execution, when they were sticking the needles in his legs and his arms and by his neck to find the veins, he was very talkative to them, laughing, everything. It was one of the most bizarre events I've ever witnessed in my life.
Now talk about the Ohio's uniqueness in terms of their choice of execution. Tell us a little bit about just the brief history that you have about it, and how do they execute people today. You do take us through that in the book. Take us through that.
Sure. So Ohio used to have the electric chair, and then once everybody started going to lethal injection, Ohio was one of the states that abolished the electric chair and went solely with lethal injection. And since that time period, that all the states that have decided to use the primary method of lethal injection, Ohio included, we've run into problems with the drug manufacturers, because a lot of the drugs are manufactured in other countries, be it over in Europe or in Canada, places like that, that do not believe in the death penalty. And these medications, all of the medications that are used to put to death these inmates, are supposed to be utilized to save lives in surgeries and things of that nature. So when the drug manufacturers get wind of an execution that has taken place with their drugs, then they no longer will supply that drug. So of the executions that I've witnessed in Ohio, the multiple executions, even though they've all been lethal injections, they all have been different lethal injections. The very first one was the three-drug cocktail, which was the sodium pentothal, the pancurium bromide, and the potassium chloride. That was the very first one. Then they stopped producing the sodium pentothal for that purpose, and then they went to a two-drug cocktail, and now we're down to a one-drug cocktail, and I've seen them all. But over the last 2 years, in 2014 and now, or I'm sorry, 2015 and now 2016, the state of Ohio has put in a moratorium. They've stopped all executions for those 2 years in order to try to figure out the complexity of this drug issue, or do we need to bring back a different method of executions? And that's where we're at right now. So there were no executions in 2015, and there'll be none in 2016, solely because of the lethal injection, the drugs that are used, and that the laws in the state of Ohio will not allow a compounding drug company or pharmacy to make the drugs if they're manufactured elsewhere already. So it's one of those weird laws that Ohio has on the books that prevents us from making the drugs, even though here in Sandusky, Ohio, we have a compounding pharmacy that is more than willing to make the drugs and donate them, because I have spoken to them. The law will not allow that, since those drugs are already manufactured elsewhere.
Yeah, incredible, still political. You do include, and I'll just mention this, I found this fascinating, is the gas chambers used in 3 states, I believe. Firing squad is in 3 states. Hanging is in 2 states. And the electric chair is in 8 states. And you say predominantly everybody, there's more so, believes in the lethal injection. And you also say there's many botched executions where the government is actually sued. Tell us just a little bit about that.
So sometimes understand that every method that is used with lethal injection, there is no doctors that are involved. There are no nurses that are involved, no anesthesiologists, because the oath that they take is to always do no harm. So therefore, they can never be a part of an execution. So in Ohio and many other states, what they'll use is licensed EMTs in the prison. Guards will take place, you know, and help out with the procedures and things like that. So oftentimes, they can't find the veins because they're not really educated enough in that area to do it. Not to mention, as I've watched them very closely, a lot of them are shaking quite a bit because I think at that point they realize that they're trying to insert a needle that's going to be taking the life of a human being, and I think that finally gets to them psychologically. So sometimes they miss the veins. There's actually an inmate that's in Ohio's prison right now that I dealt with in the past that a good friend of mine, Doug Shearer, who's head of the Vindication Project, he and I are working closely together on this inmate because he's the only one to ever survive an execution in modern history. And the reason being, it took over 2 hours. They stuck him 18 different times, 18 different places, started to try to push the drugs through, and the drugs never entered the veins. So the governor had to call, because there is a phone inside the execution chamber, that rang after 2 hours. They halted the execution. They were assuming, the attorneys anyways, that they would not be allowed to execute him again because it would fall under double jeopardy. And just about a month and a half ago, the Supreme Court ruled that since the drugs never really entered the veins, then the execution process didn't start. So he's been put back on the list to be executed. And I, from the psychological standpoint, am dealing with him because I've never talked to anybody that has gone through the entire step before of saying your final goodbyes, having your last meal, making your last statement, giving everything away, your last will and testament, surviving it, and then have to do it all over again. So I'm going at it from that standpoint, from looking at the psychological aspect, and the only two people that he will deal with are Doug and myself. So I'm fortunate enough to have that ability to still go down on death row and deal with the individuals like that. But there are some states, just last month, like the state of Virginia, they had the governor had to sign a bill to either bring back the electric chair or try to find a different method of execution because of the way the lethal injections have been going. And there are a few other states that want to join like Utah and that, and bring back the firing squad as well, because it seems to be more humane way to do it, and it's a lot less political when it comes to the manufacturing of the drugs.
We're going to use this as an opportunity to talk about sponsor of this program tonight, and that's Loot Crate. Loot Crate is a mystery crate filled with exclusive items from the biggest and best pop culture franchises delivered right to your door every month. Exclusive items including apparel, collectibles, licensed gear, and unique one-of-a-kind must-haves. Loot Crate partners with top brands including Marvel, Nintendo, Call of Duty, and Star Wars to get you every month exclusive products. A one-month plan is $13.95 per month plus $6 shipping and handling, total price $19.95. That is a recurring one-month plan. So for less than $20 a month, you get 6 to 8 items that you cannot get anywhere else and no commitment. You're in control. For the month of May, Loot Crate celebrates the coming season of blockbuster movies such as Captain America: Civil War, with May's Mystery Loot Crate featuring 2 Marvel items and also Warcraft and Dragon Ball Z, plus Loot Crate's monthly T-shirt and pin. But you only have until May 19th, and that's coming up real quick, to get May's Loot Crate. So go to www.lootcrate.com/truemurder, and that code is truemurder, lootcrate.com/truemurder, and see what Loot Crate is all about. Every month, a lucky Loot Crate member wins a mega crate valued at over $2,000, loaded with exclusive collectible gear, tech gadgets, game systems, apparel and accessories, and other items so big and epic they can't fit in their monthly crates. Loot Crate assembled the Star Wars Limited Edition Crate, a one-time-only collection of Star Wars collectible and gear, which was valued at over $150. So head to www.lootcrate.com/truemurder. And remember, May's Mystery Loot Crate featuring the Marvel items is only till May 19th, I believe, at midnight Pacific Standard Time. So that's May's Loot Crate. www.lootcrate.com/truemurder. Now, when we last left off, I wanted to ask this question. Other than being a psychologist, what do you think it is that you bring to these inmates? What is the reason why these inmates on death row, why would they speak to you, and why were they so candid with you? What is it about you and your position and these inmates that makes it that they want to confide in you?
I would say that based on the way that I respect them as a person, because they have done some very, very horrible things. They've committed horrible murders and rapes, some of them multiple victims. And there are a lot of people out there, victims' families, that have every right to hate them and want them dead. But they have not done anything wrong to me. So when I go and talk to them, I dress very casual. I don't go by Dr. Kimberlin. It's by, you know, it's first name basis, Bill. I talk to them and with them, not at them or above them. I'll joke with them. I'll laugh with them. I of course, utilize a lot of the skills I learned in the field of psychology with the least amount of questions I ask them, the more they'll tell me. So I don't come at them in an invasive way, and I treat them as a person. And I think that's what they like about me the most. Just it's another human to human contact that isn't an authority figure, that isn't going to look down upon them or judge them the entire time that I'm interviewing them. And I don't do it in a clinical setting. I do it in their setting. So when I'm on death row, I'm in their house, not in my office. And I think that makes them a little bit more relaxed as well. So that's what got them to open up in the beginning. Now it has mushroomed so much because that my name gets passed along on not
right.
just Ohio's death row now, but all over. And now more and more of them reach out to me because they feel that I'm a stand-up guy. I never lie to them, whatever they ask me, because I already know they know the answers to. They know where I live. They know where my wife teaches. They know where my daughter lives, my son, where he goes to school. They know all of this typically before they even reach out to me. So when they ask me those questions, really they're trying to see if I'm going to stumble and lie to them. And of course, I would never do that. So when they see that I'm very upfront and honest with them, then they return that favor to me.
Now, when you talked about horrible crimes, speaking of horrible crimes, probably the worst criminal killer that you spoke to, at least among the worst, was Anthony Sowell. And he's been featured on this program with a fine book by Steve Miller called Nobody's Women. 11 victims, I believe. You have 11 women victims. A particularly disgusting and gruesome killer. Tell us about your correspondence, how it came to be, and tell us more about your correspondence. What was it contained? What did he have to say, Anthony Sowell?
So I checked my mail one day, and it was a short letter, not even maybe a paragraph, and it was from death row, and it said Anthony Sowell on it. So I opened it, and it said flat out, Dear Mr. Chamberlain, my name's Tony Sowell. I hear you're a stand-up guy on death row and a good person to talk to. I'm going to have you checked out, and if you check out, I'll talk to you. I'll be in touch. And that's all it said. So I found that to be, you know, quite interesting, especially since, you know, he is, you know, a high-profile serial killer, at least here in Ohio. And it wasn't long after that that I received another letter from him, and it stated that I did check out, and it included the forms for me to fill out to come visit him. And he said, come down anytime and we'll talk. So I went down a number of times. The thing with Anthony, though, is he's a very controlling individual. And when I received the letter, because of the position that I am in, both as psychologist and then working for the courts before and still a relationship with the courts now, of course the FBI was kind of interested in seeing if he was going to admit to any other victims out there instead of just the 11, because they found all 11 victims that he kept in his home, in his backyard and everything.
Right.
But I was under the impression, as many others, that there are probably more victims out there. But Anthony was very new to death row and is still new to death row, so there's no incentive for him to talk about other victims. But he's a very intelligent individual, was in the United States Marine Corps, was married, had a child. The wife, after he had divorced her, was killed in a factory accident. He would not give me his daughter's name, but told me a lot about them. And we talked for hours and hours each time. But he always wanted to be in control. He wanted me to write a book specifically about him, not anybody else on death row. He wanted me to only have his artwork, not any other inmate's artwork. And he wanted me to pay for certain things. And, of course, I wouldn't agree to any of those terms. So we didn't really part well when it was all said and done, because I didn't give him the glory that he wanted. Because the serial
right.
killers that I deal with, or the mass murderers, their biggest fear is to be forgotten. And that's Anthony Sowell's biggest fear. He does not want to be forgotten. He wants to be known as the most notorious serial killer in the state of Ohio. And for some reason, Ohio has a lot of high-profile killers, because this is, you know, our state is where Charles Manson was born and Jeffrey Dahmer lived and was born, and then, of course, Anthony Sowell and that. So he just wants to be known to everybody as the most notorious serial killer, and I would not glorify him in the way that he wanted. So I interviewed him countless times, and then I ended up cutting ties with him because I was getting nowhere with him.
You include a couple other, a few other examples, and we'll go through them, and just I'll ask you to talk about them. James Filiaggi.
Yes.
Talk about him.
Very charismatic individual. In fact, he went to the college that I teach at, got his associate's degree there, went on and got his bachelor's degree, so he's very educated. He was also ex-military and hunted down his ex-wife when he found out she was getting engaged to somebody else, and broke in and chased her down to the neighbors and killed her in the closet, and tried to kill the neighbor, but the gun wouldn't go off, and he escaped. They ended up catching him, and subsequently was given the death penalty. But the only one that I've ever had that had such a huge following, people liked James Filiaggi, and in fact, after his execution, they had a funeral and a wake in his hometown, and there was something like 200 people that actually attended it. I was invited to go, but when one of my inmates are executed, then that file is closed and I'm done with that individual, so I didn't attend it. But he would write, correspond with me on a daily basis, was very concerned about my well-being every time I came to death row, wanted to know if I needed anything on the outside, and this was all the way up to his execution. So he was probably the only one, although he was never remorseful, he never admitted to being remorseful and never acted remorseful. He's the only one of all of my inmates that he could literally be sitting right next to you and be one of your best friends, and you would never realize that he did the things that he did. Very, very, very charismatic individual. So I spent a lot of time with James before he was finally executed.
Now you include another gentleman, Stephen Hugely, and it was an incredible amount of letters. So tell us what was contained in the letters and correspondence from Stephen Hugely.
Yeah, it's Stephen Hugely, and he was a character. He was actually he's actually on death row in Tennessee. So when I started doing my research in Ohio, somehow he got my name in Tennessee and started writing me, and then wanted me to have exclusive rights to all of his stories and everything else. A very needy individual, though. He would write letters sometimes, you know, like 100, 150 pages long that I'd have to have bound.
Wow.
In order to not lose them. And he had shot and killed his mother, shot her 15 times, threw her over the bridge, was given a life sentence in Tennessee, turned around, killed another inmate over some money that was owed, again, given another life sentence. And then his prison psychologist, he did not like his prison psychologist, and that individual talked down to him, treated him very disrespectful, and he decided that he was just going to kill him, and then that way there they'd have to give him the death penalty. So he waited till his next appointment, and he had a shank, and he stabbed him 64 times because he said that he figured if he put enough holes in him, they couldn't plug them all. So Stephen, and he was actually just in the news last year, again, because of having a cell phone on death row, and he had taken pictures and had them downloaded to a dating website, and there's Stephen in a gated community on a dating website, and he's on death row awaiting his execution. So they're very
incredible.
Brilliant behind bars.
Sure. You have called William Sapp the most evil man you have ever encountered. Tell us why.
William Sapp is, in my opinion, from a psychological standpoint, professional and personal opinion, pure evil. He is, when I went to talk to him, he had reached out to me to ask if I wanted to see him, and I said, sure. just based on the letter that he had written me, he seemed very intriguing. He said that nobody would ever really be able to stomach his stories. So I found that as a challenge. I went down there to death row, and the guards very rarely ever talked to me. But when they found out I was talking to Sapp, they were stunned, because he, not only does he not talk to anybody, but he was suspected at the time of killing 74 victims. And they asked me, am I going to be able to find out, because the feds would be very interested. And at the time, I said, I have no idea. I've never met the guy. I don't know if we're going to talk about the weather or what. So I interviewed him a few times, and then finally got to the point where I said, listen, you know, I hear you're good for 74 murders. He looked me right in the eyes. He said, no, absolutely not. He said, anybody that ever kills anybody, they never forget killing a person. And he said, anybody ever tells you that they can't remember certain details or certain things about, then they're lying. He said, I've killed 50 people, not a single one more, and I know where all 50 of them are at. They have some of the bodies. I know where the rest of them are at. And he would just go on about how he would rape and torture these victims before he killed them. His thinking was, if you are 10 years old or older, then you're fair game for sex, as long as you appeared to be 10 years old or older, because in his warped mind, he didn't want to rape a child, yet a 10-year-old to him wasn't a child. His first brush with the law was when he was a young child. He lit his biological mom on fire, tried to kill her. So that set that whole dynamic in motion. And in fact, I have three maps to three different bodies, one in Ohio, two in Florida, that Doug Scheer and I are also going to collaborate on to locate those bodies, because working with the FBI, they agree that they believe that the maps are really good. But like the drug thing, when it comes to lethal injection, there's also politics involved in law enforcement. So unfortunately, the bodies are of prostitutes and are of no significant value, I'm assuming, to the federal government. So unfortunately, there are families out there that are missing loved ones, and we're hoping to locate those and have some closure for some families. And in William's case, he will give me the rest of them after we locate these, because he's upset that we haven't dug these bodies up already. He's coming to the end of his time on death row, and I think he's going to start getting more and more desperate to see what he can do to extend his stay on death row instead of being executed. But as far as evil, I've never in my life interviewed anybody more evil than him. To see it in his eyes, how much he loves to rape and kill. And in fact, he has a couple daughters that he has not seen since he's been on death row. And I asked him one time, we were sitting there eating, and I said, well, what would you say to your daughters if I brought them here? You say you have no compassion, no feelings, nothing. You don't know what love really is. You have two wonderful daughters. What would you say to them if I brought them here? And he thought for a few minutes, looked me dead in the eye. He said, I wouldn't say anything to them. I'd kill them. If they were sitting here right now, I would kill them. One of my biggest regrets is I didn't kill them before I came to death row. And it's just, you know, the look in his eyes, you know, the tone of his voice, how calm, cool, and collective he is. It's like he looks right through you. So, yeah, that's by far the most evil person I've ever interviewed.
When you're talking about 50 people, that's incredible, too. So that is a number just conveniently or interestingly just one above the Ridge, the Green River Killer.
Yeah.
He always kept a memento from each victim, so a little trophy from each victim, and also enjoyed sex after death with these corpses, right?
Correct. You know, he says, and I believe him because I've had other inmates that have admitted to being necrophiliacs, having sex with the victims afterwards. But he thinks it's a common type of action because I would, when I asked him about this, I said, you would literally have sex with them a day or so later? And he said, well, yeah, wouldn't you? So in their warped mind, what they think they're doing is normal. They think us as abnormal. He admitted that the longest he had ever went was 5 days, where he went back and had sex with the body 5 days later. He would always take something from them. It might be a nipple. It might be a part of an ear, a finger. It could be jewelry. It could be anything like that. But he always kept something. And his MO was, he believes, at least this is how he classifies himself, as a cleaner. He would always clean up afterwards to try to not leave a crime scene. He would dispose of the bodies, usually around railroad tracks or anywhere that there was a significant dump or landfill or anything close by. So when the decomposition of the body started, that smell would not stand out from any of the other smells. So he was very cold, very calculated, and even admitted that he was a very nice-looking guy, very trustworthy, and lived a double life. Otherwise, he said, how could I kill and rape so much? Because people, if they're afraid of me, they'd go the other way. He had a way of just attracting people, albeit the majority of them prostitutes. He said nobody ever really feared him. The thing is, he said, I never set out to kill everybody either. Some of them I would let go. But as soon as they started praying to God or telling me that I can't kill them because they have children at home or don't kill them because of this or that, then he said they're dead automatically. He said because that's one thing you never tell him is no. He does not appreciate anybody telling him no to anything. So that's why I said that he was just one of the most evil men ever.
Now, in this continuance of this evil, you talked about Christopher Newton, and they got together and they both exchanged rape stories. Newton
yes.
wanted to molest his cousin in exchange, incredibly, that he said, listen, let me molest you and I'll let you witness my execution. Wow.
Yes.
A privilege.
Yes.
So what happens to Christopher Newton and Sapp?
Are you saying what happened to them or what happens to them or...
What happens between them?
Oh, well, at the time they were housed in Mansfield. That's when Mansfield was housing death row. And you would be able to have a rec partner when you went outside in Mansfield, meaning that you were paired up with somebody. And those two were so deranged, nobody else on death row would really hang around them because they were even too monstrous for a lot of other people on death row with their thoughts and their actions. So those two hit it off perfectly fine. And in fact, William Sapp had told me that Newton was the only person on death row that he got along with. And oddly enough, there's an inmate in San Quentin but that's also a pretty nasty individual, Philip Jablonski. Those two know each other and have corresponded to each other through attorneys in mail. So for some reason, they're able to attract one another when they have that type of behavior. And those two, again, they set themselves out from the rest of them just from their actions and their behavior alone. They are not that there's any normalcy on death row, but those two are far from being like most inmates that you would ever come across.
You include another case that's unbelievable in this, Frank Spisak, self-proclaimed Nazi, and somebody that wants believes he's trapped in another gender's body. So tell us about the sex change and Frank Spisak.
Yeah, Frank Spisak was definitely a case study for a psychologist, and I enjoyed that part of it, because when Frank Spisak was growing up, he was bullied a lot because of his size and his demeanor, and he wanted to become the next Adolf Hitler. He was about the same height. He would dress like him, had the mustache and everything like that. And he wanted the notoriety as the head of the Aryan Brotherhood. So his belief was, if you were not a WASP, a white Anglo-Saxon Protestant, then you had no business living. And that's the belief that he subscribed to. So he went to Cleveland State University one time and just killed five people, wounded other ones, whether they were Jewish or black or whatever. That's what he was aiming for, minorities, because if you were Jewish, you were dead. If you were black, you were dead. If you were gay, you were dead. That was his thinking. They put him on death row, and he was actually on death row for 28 years before his execution took place. So he was one of the longest ones to stay on death row. And this transformation that Frank Spisak went through to become Francis Anne, because then he discovered that he was a man trapped in a woman's body, so he changed his name to Francis Anne. He would have sex with other inmates on death row on a regular basis, because it wasn't supposed to be allowed, but it was looked the other way. So he went from hating homosexuals to being one. He ended up, he went from hating African Americans and killing them to having an African American pastor, and then also wanting to become a woman himself. So the dynamics of Spisak, I would have liked to have talked to him more, but he reached out to me towards the end of his time and asked me to be there for his execution, and I was the last person to ever speak to him before they took him over to the death chamber and proceeded with the execution. But he was different from starting out wanting to kill everybody that wasn't a white Anglo-Saxon Protestant to the end of his life, where he wanted to become a female and had an African-American pastor there to deliver spiritual rites to him. At first, I thought Frank was going to be very remorseful because of speaking to him in the death cell. He seemed like a deer in headlights. He couldn't believe that the day was here. Wanted people to know that he wasn't that monster anymore. Gave me his personal effects that were in the death cell. So I was thinking that maybe, just maybe, there was a sense of remorse there. But then when they strapped him to the table, and when you're allowed to make your last and final statement, he gave it in German, which it just infuriated the three witnesses on the victim's side, because that was like rubbing salt into the wounds, because he only ever tried to speak German before when he was killing everybody, wanted to be the next Adolf Hitler and everything else. Fast forward 28 years later, and he's on his deathbed there, and the last statement he gives is in German. So that tells me he wasn't remorseful.
Right, certainly. Now, you talk about the last person that you've seen executed, which was February 2015, and Fred Treisch. This is incredible, too, the story of his mother being, you know, I know mothers can be supportive, but tell us how supportive his mother was, and, you know, sort of the charm, again, another charismatic sort of guy, but, again, you stress it. You got to remember what this guy's crimes are. So tell us a little bit more about Fred Treisch and his mom and his crimes.
So Fred Treisch was involved in a shootout where he killed a store clerk and tried to kill some police officers. And had a history of violence in the past of robbing places and not killing the victims, but if they were female, sometimes he would duct tape them, tie them up, strip them naked first, tie them up, and then he would take light bulbs and he would insert them into the vaginas of the females and then kick them to where the light bulb would explode inside of them before he would leave. So very deranged in that sense. was very much an addict, smoked crack on a regular basis. He was on death row for 18 years before he was executed. 16 of those 18 years, he smoked crack still on death row on a regular basis because there's a lot of drugs, a lot of contraband that's smuggled in to death row, mostly through the guards, whether it's alcohol or drugs or pornography or anything like that. But what you need to get in there is the money. And Fred's mother was his main supplier for money. So what she would do is she would take usually a $100 bill every time she would come to visit him, and she would put it in a condom and put it up inside of her vagina. And the reason that she would use a condom instead of anything else was so it couldn't be detected if they decided to put them through a machine to search them. So when she would get in to see Fred, and she was allowed to buy certain things out of the vending machine for them, and she would buy him a bag of chips and a pop, she would open up the chips. First, she would ask to go to the restroom, and they would allow her to. She would go into the restroom. She would take the condom out of her vagina with the $100 bill in there, and she would come out, and then she would place that in the bag of chips when nobody was looking, and then give the bag of chips to Fred, and then Fred would eat the chips. He would swallow that condom that just came out of his mother, and then later on in the evening, he would, when he would go to the restroom, go to the bathroom, he would take that out of his stool, out of his feces, clean it off, take the crisp $100 bill out of there, and then that's what he would give to the guards in exchange for the crack that he would smoke.
Yeah, incredible. Now, this is the last person that you see executed, and you talk about that these are done, I believe, on Tuesday, 10 a.m. on the
correct
dot. And then you go to the death house. The prison, the entire prison is in lockdown. The inmates, tell us about this whole atmosphere, the inmates yelling and screaming. What are they yelling and screaming? Tell us about this entire process where you go to the death house for the 10 a.m. execution.
So all the executions take place in Lucasville. So I usually arrive at the penitentiary about 6 in the morning, maybe 5:30, quarter to 6 in the morning. I like to get there before the protesters or anything like that, and I'm processed in, and I'm taken to the debriefing room. And since I'm with one of the witnesses on the defendant's side, I'm placed in a room with the defendant's attorneys and his clergy. And then in another debriefing room are the three witnesses for the victim's side. We never come in contact with one another. So we're in there the entire time until it's time to walk across the yard, the prison yard. They keep the prison on lockdown during an execution. But a lot of the prisoners that have cells on the perimeter of the wall, of the yard anyways, can see right over to the death house, which sits almost like in the middle. And as I'm being escorted over there, they're just yelling as loud as they can. I'm not even sure what they're yelling. It's almost like when you see those movies with the gladiators and that, and it's in like a coliseum almost, and you just, everything is so surreal. The hearse is sitting there off to the side waiting for this to take place, and all of this noise is going on throughout the yard, which they're yelling through their prison windows and their cell blocks. And then you're escorted right into the death house. If I go to the death cell, which is where I talk to the individual for the last time, it's a very tiny, like, cage almost. There's a bed, a toilet, a little sink, and a writing desk, and that's it. It's completely open. There's no curtains. There's no anything. And there are three guards that sit there right in front of them 24/7 for every single minute that they're there for the last 36 hours. And every single thing that they do is recorded, whether it's they brush their teeth, they get up, they make the bed, whatever they request, every single thing is recorded. So when I go over there, even whatever we're saying back and forth is dictated down. That's the death cell. You go right around the corner from that, And it's the execution chamber is right there where the witnesses are seated. There are three seats, a little partition that doesn't even go all the way up to the ceiling, and then three seats on the other side. And then you're sitting behind this glass window. The inmate is made to walk in, and they will strap him down to the table, and then they will proceed to put the IVs in him, and then allow him to make his final statement. And you will never see the executioner. They clear the execution room out. Only the warden and one other person stands in there. When the warden buttons his top coat button on his suit, that's the signal to the executioner to start the drugs, which is behind a brick wall that you never see, but you can see the drugs if you're looking anyways. You can see the drugs flowing right down the tubes into the IV and into the inmate laying on the table. So you can hear a pin drop. Of the executions I've been there, even the one that took over 2 hours, there was no noise other than I'm writing the entire time on a tablet, and the sound of my pen is almost deafening because it's so quiet in there. And it's hard to explain the feeling itself because it's different every time. It's not something that you could ever get used to when you're watching the life of a human being taken right in front of you, especially if somebody you just got done talking to, you know, minutes before. It's not like they are in hospice care or they're terminally ill or whatever. These individuals were, for all intents and purposes, alive and well 10 minutes ago, and then you see them being strapped down and the life being taken from them right in front of you. So.
Now, with the relationships that you fostered with these inmates, and you say with the availability of arts and crafts supplies that these guys had, and obviously time on their hands, and you feature a lot of very, very talented artwork in this book. Why did you want to feature this artwork, and how important was artwork and the giving and the gifting of artwork to these inmates? Tell us about some of the stories of them imparting their personal, very, very talented artwork to you as a gift.
As most people know, there's nothing in life is really free, and in prison, it's even more expensive. So nothing is free in prison. So for these individuals to send me paintings and drawings and wooden clocks that actually work and leather goods and things of that nature and never ask for anything in return says a lot about the trust and the respect that they have for me. I didn't want to put the artwork in the book to glorify them so much as I wanted to put the artwork in there to let the general public know that they have this ability to be able to use woodworking tools and paints and supplies and things like that on death row, that this death row isn't a dark cave somewhere, that, you know, these inmates are very well taken care of. So they send me this artwork, and it has, over the years, mushroomed into this. I'm looking at my dining room table now, and there's artwork laying on it that I just received this week. You know, my son has books laying on top of some of them. My poor daughter, thank goodness she lives in Texas right now, because her bed is literally right now covered. You can't even see it. There's probably 15 paintings laying on her bed because I haven't had a chance to classify them and put them away yet. So I have hundreds of paintings and drawings sent to me from everywhere, from California's death row to Nevada to Florida and especially Ohio. And these inmates, I think in my mind anyways, they want their name out there. They want their work displayed. And the overwhelming majority of them will do nature scenes, religious scenes, have some type of religious undertone, And getting to know these inmates as well as I have, they have expressed to me and told me that they would love to paint and draw what's really on their mind, what most of us would refer to as the dark art, the skulls, the crossbones, their victims and things like that. But they are afraid to do that because it would send the wrong message out to the public, especially when it comes to time for their appeals. So what they'll do is they'll paint religious scenes, animal scenes, nature scenes, to try to trick people into thinking that they are changing while they're on death row. They were becoming a better person, when in reality, they are just still that deceitful, that conniving, that they even go so far as to think that way, so that they're careful of what they even draw or paint for me.
Wow, incredible.
Now, part of this book is your exploration. What I didn't ask you, but you did mention, but I didn't ask you specifically what your position on the death penalty was, but you said that really you could only make a decision based on someone else's opinion who had never attended an execution, that really didn't have the kind of experience that you thought it was necessary to make a really good decision one way or another. You said you really couldn't. So
right.
After you've looked at this and analyzed this with this incredible book, tell us about some of the things that you saw as the major issues to make a decision one way or another. What were those issues, and how did you deal with them, and what did you see in regards to those issues?
Well, when I first started over 9 years ago, I never once entertained the thought of writing a book. I just wanted to be able to have an educated opinion on whether I was for or against the death penalty. It came to a point where everybody kept asking me to write a book, and I felt that it was necessary. After seeing everything that goes on death row, I felt that the general public, they needed to be made aware of it, because that's our tax dollars at work, and it needs to be more transparent. So when I decided to write the book, I had to stress to people, and I still stress to people, that my opinion of the death penalty is irrelevant, and I don't try to sway anybody one way or the other, whether they're for it or against it. The book, I outline it in a way that people can really make an educated opinion after they read the book, whether they are for the death penalty or not. And my conclusions after all of these years, what I have learned that I had no idea about, was how flawed our system is, because there's really no rhyme or reason on how we enact the ultimate form of punishment in the United States, meaning taking the life of another human being. So if we're constantly talking about universal health care, we're constantly making sure that we have universal law enforcement across the board, our judicial system is universal, our educational system is universal across the board, we try to keep these certain standards all the way across the board, I would think that if we were going to take the life of another human being as a penalty, then we would be universal across the board on that in an agreement. But in fact, sure, we're so far from it. Our states can't agree on the methods to use. They argue on whether it's going to be lethal injection or electrocution. They can't agree on the number of appeals. They can't agree on what crimes should put a person on death row. And they can't agree on how long they should stay there. I look at California, my inmates out there, you're looking at 800 people on death row, and you're more than likely to die of natural causes out there because they don't execute anybody. Where then you look at states like Texas, and it seems like they run them through one after the other, and they probably average maybe one a month. Here in Ohio, nothing the last year, nothing this year. So there's no rhyme or reason. So I think the system is severely flawed. I think it's broken. I don't know if it's something that could be repaired, because everything is so political. There's so many egos involved. And so that's what I set out to show people in the book was how the system really works. And there may be people that sit there and say, you know, that's horrible. There's no way I'd want to ever support the death penalty. And then there's others that will say, you know, who cares? As long as you kill them, that's the ultimate end to it all. Make sure that they die, and however long it takes, they're fine with that. So, again, I'm not out there to sway them one way or the other, but I am out there to educate them in the sense that by the time they finish the book, they should at least be able to say, with an educated mind anyways, that they are either for it or against it.
Now, part of this is the experience, the most important part of the equation is the reality for the families of the victims in Ohio.
Yes.
You say carried out 18 to 20 years later. So tell us, again, you don't want to make, you say, listen, I'm for the death penalty, I'm not for the death penalty, but tell us what the reality is for the families in this.
You know, I feel a lot of sympathy for the families of the victims out there because, again, these inmates have told me all of this stuff firsthand. So it's not like, I've read it somewhere else or anything. These are conversations that we've had verbally. They're conversations they've written down for me, everything else. And you take these families and they're sold this bill of goods by a prosecutor who thinks that the person that perpetrated these crimes should be placed on death row and put to death because they are going to be locked away and they're going to be housed 24 hours a day, no sunshine until they, you know, are executed. They're not told how well the inmates are going to be treated because the prosecutors themselves don't know it. They're not telling the families that you have to relive this crime every single time they appeal, and how much stress is placed on those victims' families because of them reliving it, and the fact that the inmates on the inside love to control the victims' families on the outside. So by them constantly appealing and making them relive these crimes, the inmates own the victims' families until 20 years later. So if a family member of mine was killed and that individual that perpetrated that crime is put on death row, there's no closure for me until at least 20 years later when I have built up all of this anger waiting for that person to die when, in fact, the whole time I should have been that person should have been out of my mind anyways so they don't control me and I don't relive it. Whether you lock them up with life without parole and forget about them or whatever you need to do, but to rehash those crimes at every appeal and to worry constantly about you want to live long enough to watch them be executed is a horrible way to live out your life for the victim's family, that is.
Yes, and I think that is the one of the convincing arguments that I have come to myself. I don't want to weigh into it too much, but I wanted to say that when you look at the amount of time it takes, again, 20 years, and you have to relive those appeals, and some of those appeals, sometimes they get themselves lawyers that will trot out all the most outlandish and, excuses for the crimes. And so what will happen is that not only will they relive it, but they will also have the threat of some of these outlandish excuses actually working in court. So, again, a reliving, but, again, as you mentioned, these killers would love to taunt the families from their position. You know, they're totally not remorseful. So there is that added aspect, but then the aspect of just the incredible cost
yes.
of those appeals. If you think taking care of if you begrudge the prisoner for all the arts and crafts and the food and geez, where we have to house these people, well, the appeals with the death penalty process itself increases that cost, doesn't it?
Astronomical. And you know, and again, it was all a learning experience for me, and I believe it still is, because I still deal with a lot of inmates. Another learning part of this was you hear the attorneys all the time talk about how they are against the death penalty, that it is cruel and unusual punishment, that it goes against humanity and everything else. They'll say that in public, but you get them indoors in that debriefing room, they're a whole different breed of character. That's their bread and butter. That's their paycheck. They need that death penalty because they need to defend these guys in order to get paid. And the hypocrisy that is out there is just, it's stunning.
Yeah, it's incredible. And the interesting thing, or one of the more interesting things about this book, Watch Me Die, is the opinions of some of these inmates that you spoke to, their opinion of the death penalty. What was the, pick one of or two of these inmates that had the most cavalier? You say one of them was dying to die, but was there any really interesting and cavalier attitudes towards the death penalty and the imposing of it by any of the inmates?
Yeah, I mean, Chris Newton was the only one that was really just anxious to be executed. All of my other inmates, they are absolutely against the death penalty because they have, over the years, whether they have convinced themselves or they have been brainwashed by other inmates surrounding them, that, you know, a sin is a sin is a sin. So even though I may have killed 5 or 10 or 15 people, the state killing me is just as bad. So why does the state think that it should be okay to kill me when that goes against everything that everybody stands for? So they are really against the death penalty. They think that the state of Ohio is, and other states now, are doing an injustice by killing them because it's murder to them, and that makes the state of Ohio no better than what they are. So that's across the board. That's just about all the inmates. I was shocked to hear it the first few times, but anymore I expect to hear it because that's exactly how they all think about it, is you putting me to death makes you, the state, just as guilty of murder as I am, even though I killed multiple victims. And they blame the victim's family a lot.
Right. Before we close out our interview tonight, you talked about your writing partner and Douglas Shearer, you talked about tell us a little bit about the project that you guys have endeavored to take upon, involving what we mentioned was the search for, when you talked about the maps and locations, tell us a little bit more about this ongoing investigation that you're involved with.
So I have a few maps that detail exact locations of a few bodies from one of the inmates in Ohio's death row. And they're very detailed maps. They're the FBI and I had worked closely together at the time to get these maps. They agree that the bodies are probably there at those locations, but again, with the politics that we had mentioned before involved, they just don't seem to be too ambitious to go out and do anything about it, because I think they'd rather spend their time looking for Jimmy Hoffa and other things. So Doug and I decided to collaborate together to see what we can do to investigate where the locations are, and if in fact they are there, to recruit the necessary individuals to locate these bodies for the purposes of closure to the victims' families out there.
Oh, that's fantastic. I want to thank you very much, Bill, for coming on the program and talking about this incredible book, Watch Me Die. For those that might want to correspond with you or find out more about your work, tell us about what you have in terms of website, Facebook, how Tell us a little bit about that.
You know, I'm on Facebook, very active on there. It's just under Bill Kimberlin, spelled K-I-M-B-E-R-L-I-N. It'll have a cover of my book, Watch Me Die, because there's a couple different Bill Kimberlins out there. They can order the book through like Amazon.com or Barnes & Noble or Books A Million on their websites or Green Ivy Publishing. So the book's readily available out there. The last I checked, it was in 7 different countries so far it had been purchased in.
Right.
And then my actual email, which is bwkimbo@bex.net. I always respond to everybody.
Well, that sounds fantastic. I want to thank you, Bill, for coming on and talking about Watch Me Die. Thank you very much, and you have a great evening, and hope to talk to you again in the near future. Thank you.
Thank you for having me on your show. I appreciate it.
Thank you very much, Bill. Good night.
Thanks.